from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. $43 billion is an awful lot of money, but it turns out it's not nearly enough to build a high-speed rail system in California. Back in 2008, the agency created to build high-speed rail said the bill would come to $43 billion. But critics scoffed. This week, a revised business plan came out that more than doubled the cost to $98 billion. How do we know that even that sum will be enough? And where would all the money come from? Joining us to talk about all this and more is Lance Simmons. He's Deputy Director of Communications at the California High-Speed Rail Authority. Lance, welcome to Inside.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Why should people believe the revised estimate? If the $43 billion, which was the product of research, turned out to be not nearly enough, why would 98 be enough?
Well, I'll tell you, Jeffrey, yesterday we released our 2012 business plan. And that business plan is a completely new direction and a new look and a serious, honest, and transparent look at what the true costs of this are going to be. Now, there are a number of reasons why the costs have gone up. Obviously, the cost of inflation over time is an issue.
But it hasn't doubled in three years.
No, but what we have done is initially we considered completing the project by 2020. We have now stretched that out to 2033, which is an additional 13 years.
But wouldn't that make it cheaper if you spread it out over a longer period of time?
No, because the price of inflation continues to go up year in and year out. So we've got the inflationary factors, but we've also taken a very serious look at some of the criticisms that we faced over the years in our projections, particularly with respect to ridership. And we've had an internationally renowned panel of experts look at our ridership assumptions, and we've adjusted those assumptions to reflect the true costs. Also, because the original alignments, which were built into this project, were built in many years ago, several things have happened during the process. There's been an enormous amount of development, particularly in the boom of the early and the middle 2000s. We had an extensive amount of development around where alignments had been forecast. So now you have development in places where you have to readjust the alignments. Plus, we've also had an enormous amount of community input on how to build, whether to build tunnels, whether to build aerials, viaducts. All of these things contribute to increased costs. So what we have now put forward, we believe, is a very conservative and a very realistic set of economic assumptions, which will capture the costs of building this system.
You said the revised business plan is serious, honest, and transparent. Does that mean that the 2008 plan was less than serious, honest, or transparent?
It means that what we have done is we have taken we have scrubbed this thing thoroughly, and we have looked at numbers which are conservative. We don't think it's going to cost $98 billion, but on the outside chance that it will, we would rather be conservative and realistic so that if we can come in underneath that, and we think we can, that's a better way to approach this project.
What do you think is the lowest amount that it could come in at?
We think, and we've built into this business plan, that rather than building an extensive network of tunnels and viaducts, which would be required to complete the full plan from San Francisco to Los Angeles, and it gets really expensive when you get into the cities, because you have to do a lot of tunneling. You have to do a lot of viaducts because there's density there, as opposed to in the Central Valley, where you have relatively wide spaces and you have the ability to construct track along right-of-ways that already exist and aren't dense and congested. We believe that we can adopt what's known as blended operations, which essentially means that you build the system to the city gates of San Francisco and Los Angeles. And when you get close into the major metropolitan areas, you can blend services with existing rail. So in other words, if we spend money on electrifying track in those cities,
existing rail systems, you can
create this coordinated effort, this blended service.
So it'd be less than high speed in the cities, but presumably faster than current trains.
But then again, it was never going to be high speed in the cities because you're going to slow down when you come into those areas anyway.
My guest is Lance Simmons, Deputy Director of Communications at the California High-Speed Rail Authority, which this week released a revised business plan now saying that the cost of building the high-speed rail system in California could be up to $98 billion, much more than had previously been estimated. One thing that critics of high-speed rail, in particular the cost, say is California can't afford to spend all that much money. One of the responses to that is that the other expenses will have to be incurred if we don't build the high-speed rail system. In other words, more freeways, airports, and so on. How do we know what California would spend if not for high-speed rail?
Well, we know that the population in California is going to continue to grow. And we have estimates as high as by mid-century, 60 million people. We're currently at 38 million people. So the infrastructure needs are all, the demands are already there for increased infrastructure, but they're going to increase. And there are three ways which you can deal with that. One, you can build a statewide transportation system like high-speed rail to take congestion off the roads and off the airports. Two, you can continue to build more lanes of freeways and try to enhance airport capacity, which is getting increasingly difficult. There's no place to put runways in San Francisco or LAX. Or you can do the worst option, which is to do nothing. Now, you say, can we afford this? We actually can't afford not to do it because the cost of building, of meeting the demands over the next 40 years. The cost of building 2,300 lane miles of freeways and building four runways and 115 additional airport gates is estimated in inflation-adjusted dollars to be $171 billion. Now, the blended service that I talked about before, you said, you know, maybe it won't be as high as 98. If we do the blended operations, which we are advancing in here, and which we have heard from the communities they want to do and the local rail systems want to do, that cost comes down to $78.2 billion.
Regardless of where is all this money going to come from, California voters have approved $10 billion roughly in bond money, but that still leaves a lot of money to come right. from elsewhere. And the Fed's a part of the picture, but right. where is that? How are they going to be persuaded to put in more money?
Well, one of the major things that we're doing in this business plan, as opposed to the previous business plan, is we've decided we're going to approach this in bite-sized chunks. We're going to do it in segments. So the first segment, for instance, will be in the Central Valley, 130-mile segment. It's the cheapest per mile to build, and it gives you the ability to run trains at 240 miles per hour to test them to see if the systems work.
But that's the infamous stretch that critics say is stretch to nowhere.
That is, and it's not a train to nowhere. It's a $6 billion investment of which all the funds have been identified. $3.3 billion in stimulus funds from the federal government and $2.7 billion in those Prop 1A bonds, state bonds. So we have identified the funding for that. The next segment that we build will be an operational segment. We have not identified all the funding for that. We do not anticipate any federal funding for the next 3 years. We've still got money in the state Prop 1A funds. What we will do is we will work very closely, and this plan does not envision federal funds for the next 3 years, but we'll work very closely to identify federal funding mechanisms and hope that the environment in Washington, D.C. changes in order to help us promote this thing and get it running.
But what if things don't change? What if the federal government decides in a long-term way that it really needs to focus on deficit reduction and just will not have money for this kind of thing?
Well, I'll tell you, when you build that first segment, that $6 billion segment in the Central Valley, it has value. It has usefulness because it serves as the spine for a system which can be picked up at any time. It can be picked up down the road, and you can build this by segments. You can run the San Joaquin Amtrak service on those lines and cut the cost, cut the time in a trip from San Francisco to L.A. by something like 45 minutes. So it does have utility, it does have value, but it serves as the foundation for building onto this system when we can identify the funds, regardless of when that is.
My guest is Lance Simmons of the California High-Speed Rail Authority. We got an email from a listener called John in Concord who says, in his opinion, there's been a great mistake made in route selection. And he refers to the huge jog that the line is projected to take to the east in order to serve Palmdale and Lancaster. This is in Southern California. He says it would be much better to have, quote, a more direct line south from Bakersfield. In fact, he says this should be the initial segment constructed. It would close the current gap in Amtrak operations that require a shift to buses in order to reach Los Angeles. It would be a wise expenditure of public funds.
I mean, there is always going to be controversy over alignments, obviously. We have, in our engineering studies and in all of our public meetings and public hearings, have decided that the best way to build this line is the way in which we're proceeding. And every other system in the world has been built this way, where you build that first leg so that you can test the systems, you can test the rolling stock, you can test the signals. You've got to be able to test to make sure that these trains can operate at these high speeds. You can't do that in highly congested and dense areas. So the Central Valley offers the best place along the route to do that.
What about private sector investment? When the High-Speed Rail Authority CEO Roelof van Ark was on our program, he said that he expected private sector investment. But why would the private sector invest when it's not even certain the extent to which either the state or the federal governments can invest?
Well, first of all,
beyond what they've already done.
Well, first of all, you're not going to get private investment until you have an operating segment, until you have a viable high-speed rail operating segment completed. Once you complete the first section, which we talked about, that initial $6 billion segment, the first operating segment is the next segment that gets built. And that will either go north to San Jose or it'll go south to the San Fernando Valley. Once you get that operating segment up and running, and the cost, by the way, of the operating segment is somewhere in the neighborhood. If you go south, the cost is $27 billion. So at the 30, because of the $6 billion initial segment, and then the $27 billion operating segment, if you decided to go south first, would mean that you'd have about a $33 billion investment. At that point, you start to get net operating revenues. And at that point, capital, private capital, will come into the equation.
And finally, Lance Simmons, assuming things continue, when would actual real construction start on the Central Valley, the first Central Valley portion?
Well, we are planning to start construction in fall of next year. That segment will be completed by 2017. And the operating segment that we talked about should begin in 2015. That will be completed by 2021. And then the second operating segment, depending on whether you go north or south first, that second segment should be completed by 2026. We believe with the blended services that I talked about, with the blended operations, we can have a train, a high-speed rail, viable by 2030, which means in 18 years, you will be able to get on a train in Los Angeles, arrive in San Francisco in 3 hours, and that train ride will cost you about 83% of what it costs for an airline ticket, so okay, between $60 and $80. And we think that we can have that in 18 years.
Well, of course, all this remains to be seen. In the meantime, Lance Simmons, Deputy Director of Communications at the California High-Speed Rail Authority, joining us today to talk about the authority's revised business plan for high-speed rail in California. Lance, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, how does the NBA lockout affect Sacramento, and what are the prospects for even a shortened NBA season starting? You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Joining us with Insight Online today is Insight Senior Producer Jen Picard. Hello, Jen.
Hi, good morning. Well, you just heard the latest news about the business plan for California's high-speed rail project. What do you think about the projected costs and the proposed route? Do you think a bullet train will actually come to fruition in California? Send an email with your thoughts to insight@capradio.org or leave a comment on our Facebook page, Insight on Capital Public Radio. And in just a few minutes, you'll hear a discussion about how the MBA lockout is affecting the Sacramento region. Last week, we asked for your thoughts on the situation, and listener Melissa had this to say. My first thought goes to the entire economic system that is supported by the MBA organization and is dependent upon the games occurring. How many people are essentially unemployed while the games are not happening? I hope those working through these issues keep that in mind. Well, I'm sure there are plenty of other people wondering the same thing, and hopefully we can shed a little light on it in just a few minutes. Also, don't forget to check out our website, capradio.org/insight. You can find more information and links to all of our guests, including photos and videos. And on today's page, you'll find a YouTube video for Ramblin' Jack Elliott, who we will be talking with later in the show.
It's a great video.
Yes, it is.
Thanks, Jen.
You're welcome.
Today should have been the regular season home opener for the Sacramento Kings, their opponents, the Houston Rockets. But there is no game because of the months-long NBA lockout, still with no sign of resolution. The season's first month of games has been scrapped and more cancellations could follow. What impact is the lockout having on Sacramento businesses and the city's attempt to raise the money to build a new arena? And what are the prospects for even a shortened NBA season starting? We've got two guests who are following these different parts of the story. We'll start with Aileen Voisin, Sacramento Bee sports columnist, who's on the phone. Aileen, welcome back to Insight.
It's good to be back, as always, Jeffrey.
How close are the NBA owners and the NBA players to coming to a deal? It seems like they're coming and going all the time, and we keep hearing that they're on the verge of a breakthrough, and then it falls apart.
Well, you know, the issue, I guess the problem is they've pretty much narrowed it down to one issue. They've got about probably 95% of the ancillary issues worked out, both the ones dealing with the system luxury tax, things like that. The thing that is holding them up again is the split of the basketball revenues, the annual revenues. The players under the last contract were given as much as 57% of annual revenues gained, and the owners below that, obviously. And the owners going into this discussion said that that was just not tenable. You know, they claimed 22 of 30 owners have lost money. Of course, we can't verify that, but I do hear from that it's not 22, it's very close to that figure from what my sources tell me. But, you know, they've resolved most of the major issues, Larry Bird rights, mid-level exceptions, you know, the issues around the revenue. And, you know, they sit at a table now, and they're looking at they're very close. The players are now have moved down to 52.5% of revenue is their demand. And the players are holding, the owners are holding firm at 50-50. They want an equal split of this. You know, the issue, part of the issue is that the players making these concessions, going down to 52%, that's a huge jump. And additionally, you know, they've made with some of the concessions they've made on other things like length of contract, movability, you know, the free agents are going to give up salary. They want to make sure that their flexibility and ability to move within other teams and remain competitive in that regard are still maintained. And, you know, these two go hand in hand. So there's a little stubbornness going in here on that. Players don't feel like they have conceded enough, and the owners are really, really adamant about that 50-50 split.
You said that the NBA says that about two-thirds of its owners are losing money. Is it fair to assume that those money-losing owners include the Maloofs who own the Sacramento Kings?
No, I don't. Honestly, I think they probably do. They're probably in that group, but not by much, because they had the lowest payroll in the league by far this year. So they didn't. Everything I was told about them, they either broke even or lost a little bit. So they might be in that 22 of the 22. They might be just outside the group of 22. But that was by design. I mean, we saw what they did. They shed their big contracts. Signed. They have several young rookies that don't make nearly as much as even a 3- and 4-year veteran.
Are the Maloofs players in these negotiations?
Gavin Maloof has been back in New York at several of the negotiations. But, you know, I think that their position right now, it's two things. One, they don't typically get involved in these things. They're very, very big backers of David Stern.
The commissioner.
You know, the commissioner, and whatever he says, they pretty much go along with. Secondarily, I mean, you know, they had their own issues with their trying to relocate the franchise in March and April, and I think that, you know, they don't exactly have the cachet, the standing right now with the other owners, because the other owners basically said, you know, this plan to move to Anaheim is really not ready. They were not totally unimpressed with it. So I don't think right now that the boys are going to go in there strutting with the economic and just the professional leverage of a Mark Cuban or a Mickey Arison in that regard. But I also will say that they're not one of the ones that eight owners sent David Stern a letter 2 years ago, basically demanding more revenue sharing for the small market teams, and they were not among them. I mean, they leave that stuff to Stern. They don't get into the detail part of it. Their concern going in here clearly was the revenue sharing element, and we still don't know the details of that, but we do hear that it's going to be almost at least tripled, maybe quadrupled when it all is said and done here, and that was their major concern going in.
There may be no way to answer this, Aileen Voisin, but I've heard that some of the big market owners are more willing to cut a deal with the players than the small market owners, who feel more of a financial squeeze. However, the Maloofs are in an unusual situation. They're currently in a small market, but looking to move to a big market, i.e. Southern California. Do you know how that might affect their position?
No, they're still, they think of themselves as small market owners. I mean, they're still thinking that an arena is going to get built here, which is what Joe in particular has always wanted to, has always, you know, hoped for. So they're pushing with the small owners here, is my understanding. Again, we're talking small market to mid-market teams, and that takes up two-thirds of the league. You know, the big cities, there's just a couple of them here. So the big city owners, Jerry Buss, James Dolan, Mark Cuban, they're outnumbered. Mm-hmm. You know, by their colleagues, which is making it, you know, the dynamic in there very interesting.
Today would have been the season opener for the Sacramento Kings. Aileen Voisin is on the phone. She's a Sacramento Bee sports columnist. In our studio is the Sacramento Bee business reporter, Dale Kasler. Dale, welcome back to Inside.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey.
What kind of impact is the lack of an NBA season having on Sacramento businesses?
Well, the most obvious is the restaurants that do a big business on game nights. There are restaurants in the Natomas neighborhood that even if a game isn't sold out, the places are packed.
Because it could be 17,000 people going to that area.
Well, exactly. Restaurants, there are hotels in Sacramento that do business just by hosting the visiting teams. It sort of ripples through the community. You have about 700 people who work for the Kings organization, most of them part-timers. They're not getting laid off, but their hours are being cut because there are fewer events. You know, the arena has not gone dark, but on game night, you know, tonight would have been a big night. Tonight would have been a huge night, probably a sellout, and it'll be empty.
So it's probably not possible to quantify exactly what the economic impact is, but when you add it up across all the different aspects of this, it could be quite significant, especially given the general economic problems here.
Right. It's the last thing Sacramento needs is one more dent in the economic structure.
Now, another impact that the NBA problems could have on Sacramento is on the efforts to raise money to build a new arena. Dale, do you know of any impact, negative or positive, I guess, on the arena efforts because of the NBA lockout?
That's a great question, and nobody really knows. It could cut either way. You know, it's important for your listeners to realize that, you know, this isn't just any season for the Sacramento Kings. This could well be the last season. They've said, and the NBA has said, that the team will almost certainly move if there's not a deal in place by next spring. Now, there is one school of thought that says if you have the team doing reasonably well and the attendance doing reasonably well, that it creates some kind of goodwill. It extends the momentum that was generated last spring when the team agreed to stay in town. And that it makes it easier for a member of the city council to approve whatever deal comes down the pike. The other school of thought is that this is strictly a business arrangement and it doesn't matter. They're just one tenant out of many in this new arena if the arena gets built. And it doesn't matter if games are being played or not. It's hard to tell.
because the Foo Fighters were playing a concert last night at Power Balance Pavilion, and so those concerts could go on regardless of whether there are Kings games.
That's absolutely right. There's Disney on Ice is coming. There's other things coming, but you're missing some dates because of the player lockout, and they are the anchor tenant.
Aileen Voisin, what do you think about that? Do you think that having no Kings games has an impact, for better or for worse, on the efforts to build an arena?
Well, I don't think it... As Dale spoke to the economic impact, I mean, I've also had a feel for all the people that work in that building that I've seen for years. I mean, I clearly see that. A lot of those people, this is their second job. This is how they put their kids through college. But I would say that anytime you don't play, we saw the poll that allegedly Sandy Sheedy had conducted and the impact of how people feel about a new arena and how to finance and whatnot. And I actually thought it was pretty, I would have been fairly encouraged if I were people around here, the politicians, because, there's no play. And there's been labor war and labor talk and labor strife. This has been going on for months. And people don't want to hear that. They're tired of the bad news, right? So I think you get an inherent negativity reception in the community because of that. So all I can think about, if you're playing basketball, it has to be a plus. To me, it's a win-win. I mean, you're trying. You've got an interesting young team now. You know, the Kings drafted Jimmer Fredette, who's very, very popular. I mean, we forget that we haven't seen this kid. I saw him at a charity golf tournament in June. Now he's coming in. They've got Cousins that is coming off a good year. There's a lot of very intriguing elements of this young team now, unlike teams in the recent past here. So I can't imagine how that would not playing now can't be hurting, at least in a psychological way. I mean, I think people say, oh, I'm ticked off, I'm not going to come. But, you know, once they start playing and the energy comes back and people are talking about the Kings again on court, I think that is just it's a psychic boost, any which way you cut it, I think. So I certainly don't think it helps, let me put it that way, to have the Kings part of the arena dark.
Dale Kanzler, do we know anything much about the status of the efforts to build a new arena? There was a lot of talk earlier in the year as various deadlines came and went regarding coming up with plans and reports and so on. There isn't a whole lot of time left to come up with a solid plan.
Well, city officials, the city staff is working on it. They are fleshing out the financial plan. In the coming weeks, I think the city council is going to take a hard look at one aspect of the plan, which is I'll call it a partial privatization of the city's downtown parking spots. The city owns about 7,000 or 8,000 parking spaces in downtown Sacramento, and those can be turned into cash, millions of dollars in upfront cash that could be used to help anchor this effort. And the developers say this is a pretty important part of the financial package. And it's going to come before the city council before too long. So things are happening quietly in City Hall to make this happen.
But the Maloofs have made it clear that there needs to be a solid financial plan in place by early spring of next year. And if there isn't, the NBA has basically said you can move if you wish.
Oh, absolutely. And this parking thing that I referred to is one of the big pieces of that. I mean, it's not going to happen all at once, but city officials believe that if they can get the city council to sign off, that they will have a package in place by sometime next spring.
And finally, Aileen Voisin, when do you think the NBA season will start, if it does, bearing in mind that informal bet that you made in public regarding a keg?
All right, you had to remind me of that, huh? Beers here. I'm still really shocked that they didn't get this thing done twice, especially last week. I mean, I thought there was every chance that, as did almost everyone, that they were going to reach an agreement last Friday. And geez, the days just go by here. So I think that you're going to feel that now there's the pressure. We're hearing that there's some splintering within the union's ranks. David Stern seems to be putting on greater pressure now to go to that 50-50 deal, because he's got owners that are on him saying, well, we're losing money already. You need to go back 47%, whatever. So I think that there's real pressure, inherent pressure here, overt pressure on all the parties. The dynamic is getting frayed. There's a lot of carping going on, a lot of, now you've got the 24-hour news cycle. People are coming up with stuff. This person's not getting along with this person. Mm. So I think that once it reaches that, you know, you're going to see a couple players, disgruntled players now start to voice their opinions. And I do think a number, majority of players would have approved a 50-50 deal. If that had been put to a vote of the players last week, I think they would have approved that, and we'd be playing, you'd be seeing basketball now.
I see. Well, thanks so much, Aileen Voisin, Sacramento Bee sports columnist. In our studio, Dale Kasler, Sacramento Bee business reporter. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, what was America like the year after Columbus arrived? You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. What's in the news today? The man with the answer is Alan Ray, Capital Public Radio senior editor. He's in our newsroom. Alan, what's in the news?
Well, good morning, Jeffrey. The Sacramento Metro Chamber has named a new president and CEO. Not sure whether there was a nationwide search involved, but the search ended very close to home. The new leader of the chamber is former Republican Assemblyman Roger Nilo. He'll be taking over the second largest regional chamber of commerce in California.
And, of course, he has a big business background in the car dealing industry as well as a political background.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the family is long established here, so you got to figure he certainly knows where all the, well, where all the skeletons are buried.
Yes, I guess
so.
I
guess. Anyway, now, you wonder who would be surprised that not everybody was pleased with Governor Brown's proposal for pension reform? Later retirement, reduced benefits. So today, a group will be announcing a plan to put forth a ballot measure that would offer an alternative to the state's public employee pension future, and Jenny O'Mara will be covering that story this afternoon.
Okay.
Now, one way to read the new decision for non-action by the Federal Reserve is this is as good as it gets.
Oh, dear.
Oh, yeah. At the end of 2 days of policy meetings, the Fed said the economic future looked brighter now, so there will be no more attempts to stimulate or strengthen the economy, at least for right now. Those stories and more beginning at 3:30 this afternoon on All Things Considered from Capital Public Radio.
Thanks, Alan.
My pleasure.
1492 was, of course, one of the great crossroads in world history. When Columbus arrived in the Americas, he started a centuries-long process of the mass movement of people, wildlife, things, and ideas across the Atlantic and in both directions. What was life like on the American continent just before Columbus sailed the ocean blue? Author Charles C. Mann answered that question in his best-selling book, 1491. Now, in the sequel, he describes how things were in 1493. Tonight, he speaks in Stockton. Right now, he's in our studio. Charles C. Mann, welcome to Insight.
My pleasure to be here.
Was America, or what we came to know as America, that different in 1493 compared to 1491?
Well, not immediately, but very soon it became quite different. One of the big things that happened was that Europeans unknowingly brought microbes over, you know, European and Asian diseases that native people here had no experience with. And so one of the first results of Columbus was this inadvertent demographic collapse, as somewhere between 2/3 and 90% of the original inhabitants of the Americas died.
I think smallpox is one of the diseases.
One of the major diseases. And that, of course, changed everything, because wherever people are, they change the landscape around them. And when the Americas became depopulated, the landscapes all over the country changed.
Yeah. You know, people have heard about the smallpox crossing, and we've heard about famous crops like tomatoes and potatoes and tobacco and some of the animals that are well-known in the world crossing the Atlantic because of all this. But some rather surprising creatures also crossed the Atlantic, including the earthworm.
Yeah. In the northern part of the United States, there at the time of Columbus, there were no earthworms. They'd all been wiped out by the ice ages. And then earthworms are kind of pokey creatures. They don't move very much. If you had one in your backyard, it would never leave that area. And as a result, they moved north incredibly slowly, so slowly that by the time of Columbus, places like Chesapeake Bay or Massachusetts, where I live, or Minnesota, had no earthworms. And so all those, the earthworms there that are in people's gardens are of European or and recently Asian origin.
European worms?
Yes.
How do we know there were no worms there?
Well, there's a couple ways we know. One is that there are all the species there are from Europe. I mean, we can identify them. Worm experts, you know, can trace them. And in fact, one of the bizarre things about researching this book is I had to interview a bunch of worm experts and became much more acquainted with earthworms than the average person. And so you find places still in the United States that are worm-free, and you see that there's a radically different ecosystems there because earthworms are these sort of tiny ecological engineers that dramatically change the areas around them.
Yeah, so they must have had a big impact on the northern part of the United States when they returned, so
right.
to speak.
Right, and they still are. And in fact, there are these worm-free woodlands that people are trying to protect. And in places like Minnesota, where there's actually substantial areas that still haven't been invaded, there's, you know, things like the Minnesota Worm Watch. And then further up in Canada, there's sort of active anti-worm patrols trying to protect local environments.
My guest is Charles C. Mann. He's author of the books 1491 and most recently 1493 about the American continent immediately before and after the arrival of Columbus. And he's at University of the Pacific in Stockton this evening. What about crops and plants and so on? Any that particularly stand out for you beyond the obvious ones?
Well, the ones that are probably the most important were the potato, which came from the Andes and had an enormous impact on European history. Prior to the potato, the French historian Fernand Braudel was probably the first to point this out. Europe simply couldn't feed itself. It was constantly on the edge of Malthusian collapse. And when the potato comes, there's this dramatic change in Europe's fortunes. And the reason for that is that when you grow wheat or something like that, if the individual wheat plant is too productive, the head gets too big, the grain gets too heavy, and the plant falls over and dies, whereas a potato can be as big as it wants to be, and it's under the ground, and it can grow just fine.
Hard to imagine northern European cuisine without the potato.
Right, but it was without the potato until the early 18th century, and the result is that because potatoes are so much more productive, individual European farmers could get roughly four times as much food from a single acre as they could with wheat or barley or millet or the other things they've been grown. And the result was a population boom in Europe and political stability as they stopped having the kind of bread riots that had characterized European history at that time.
And the tomato also crossed the Atlantic.
Yeah. Now, the tomato's really cool. I'm a big tomato fan.
Yeah.
But it didn't have quite the impact of potato. Or the real big one in southern part of Europe was maize or corn. And that had a kind of analogous role. It's tremendously productive. It's much more productive than wheat. And so it was what made Italy finally able to feed itself.
Conversely, what crossed from Europe to America?
Initially, mainly diseases.
Along with the earthworm.
Yeah.
And the diseases.
And diseases. Probably the most important was the malaria parasite. And whereas smallpox and flu and those kind of organisms create epidemics that sort of sweep through and then sort of die down. Malaria is what they call endemic. It means it sticks around. And it dramatically changed the southern part of the United States, the Caribbean, places like Brazil, and made them much more hostile to human life than they had been before.
What impact did the arrival of Columbus and everything that followed from that have on apparently unrelated parts of the world, like in Asia?
Well, what you can say, and this is interestingly enough, the California scholars are sort of the leaders in understanding this, and some of them are at the University of Pacific. They're including Dennis Flynn and Arturo Giraldez, and they're among the first to understand that what happens with beginning with Columbus and then following with Spain's adventures in the Pacific is nothing less than the beginning of globalization, the creation of our modern interconnected world. And for the first time, all the different parts of the world that are inhabited are linked by a sort of single pulse of commerce. And one of the things that I argue in my book is that an equally important part of this is the kind of ecological unification of the world. One way to think about it is that when all these parts of the world are in constant contact with each other, you're effectively recreating Pangaea, which was the original continent 200 million years ago when all the world's parts were in a single continent before they were pulled apart by geological forces.
But all this turned out to be not good for China, at least at that time.
Well, it was both good and bad. The sweet potato and maize corn came to China. And even today, China is the largest grower of sweet potatoes in the world, about 80% of the world's crop, and second or third largest grower of maize. And it led to a huge population boom. And the problem was that growing all these crops in the uplands where they grew them, new areas for Chinese farmers, they made a lot of beginner's mistakes and created tremendous ecological devastation that led to political destabilization.
My guest is author Charles C. Mann. The concept behind your first, the first book in the series, 1491, was such a great one, and 1493 was an obvious sequel. Where could you go from there?
Well, I've kind of run out of numbers. I think I'm going to have to do something different.
Yes. On your website, you address a sort of a humorous question, which is the reason why you use the initial C as a writer, Charles C. Mann. It's kind of a funny story.
Oh, well, there's a couple of reasons, but
a couple.
Yeah, well, one of them is that my grandfather, I'm named after my two grandfathers, and the C stands for Cameron, and my Cameron grandfather was quite upset that I insisted that I use at least some part of his name. That's why I have this sort of pretentious middle initial. The other thing is that it turns out that there's this Washington Redskins former football player who has quite a following. And
yes.
I still get a lot of pestering. Still about once a week or so, I still get an email saying, somehow, are you him, you know, the Washington Redskins football player? And I say, no, if you saw me, I really don't look like him. And this is my feeble attempt at making sure that people don't understand that I am not, in fact, a former Washington Redskins star.
Well, you're best known as author of 1491 and now 1493, but you've also written many other books, and you've written many articles for well-known publications about science and related matters. But I notice in your background, a long way back, you were also one of the writers of an early episode of Law and Order.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. I did a couple of things for them. And this is really, you know, serendipity. I had a friend who was a good writer and who became one of their writers. And he and I teamed up and wrote some stuff for them. It was tremendous fun, although I learned, in fact, that I don't really want to be a television writer.
Why not?
I'm having too much fun doing what I'm doing. I don't have to deal with the networks. And it was wonderful when I was working with him because he sort of ran interference for me. But obviously, I couldn't keep doing that if I was going to keep writing for television.
And if people are watching cable, it's from 1994, the episode called Scoundrels.
Oh, yeah, that's the big one, yeah.
That's the big one, yeah. Charles C. Mann, author of the books 1491 and this year, 1493. He's at University of the Pacific's Janet Lee Theater tonight at 6. Charles C. Mann, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, folk legend Ramblin' Jack Elliott sings the blues. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Here's your weather. It'll be sunny and less breezy today in Stockton with a high of 72. And there are just a few days left in Stockton to enjoy the Dia de los Muertos art exhibit. Skulls, skeletons and more at the Mexican Heritage Center and Gallery on East Acacia Street through Monday. Otherwise, in our region, 71 degrees today in Sacramento, 70 in Yuba City, 72 in Merced, 63 in Nevada City, 52 in Reno, and 50 in Tahoe City. Partly sunny and breezy tomorrow with a chance of showers. Ramblin' Jack Elliott has been one of America's top folk singers for over 50 years. He was a friend of Woody Guthrie and an influence on Bob Dylan. But Jack Elliott isn't someone to sit on his laurels. A couple of years ago, in his late 70s, he took on a new project, the recording of a country blues album called A Stranger Here. It includes a remarkable group of musicians, including guitarist and accordionist David Hidalgo from Los Lobos. A Stranger Here went on to win a Grammy. Ramblin' Jack Elliott is coming to Sacramento. We'll talk with him in a minute, but first, one of the songs from A Stranger Here, it's Death Don't Have No Mercy.
Death don't have no mercy in this land. Death don't have no mercy in this land. Come to your house, but he won't stay long. Look in the bed and you'll find your mother gone. Death don't have no mercy in this land.
Ramblin' Jack Elliott, thanks so much for joining us today on Insight.
You betcha.
I have to say, first of all, that I can't stop listening to A Stranger Here. I'm really enjoying it. Every song on it is so good. Where did you get the idea for doing a record like that?
From the record company. It was their idea. They wanted me to do a blues album, and I thought, well, I've never done an album of blues. I always have to include at least two or three blueses in any kind of show I'm doing. And I've hung out with some of the great blues singers.
Yeah.
But I didn't ever think of myself as a blues singer. I'm kind of a cowboy singer. But we did this blues album. That was Van Dyke Parks on the piano, by the way.
Oh, yeah. All the musicians on the record are just of tremendous quality. In the liner notes for the CD, you wrote, quote, "My own loose approach to the vocals was aided by the fact that I didn't learn any of the lyrics beforehand, just listened to them twice a day for 3 months, and you were reading the printed word." Was that deliberate?
No, I wanted to learn those songs, but it takes me a long, long time to ever learn a song. In fact, I haven't learned hardly any of those songs that are on the record yet, and it's been out for almost 2 years now.
How familiar were you with all those songs before you started the project?
Well, I knew one of the songs. It's called How Long Blues. I've known that long, How Long Blues for 50 years. That's how long. That's how long I've been singing How Long. I learned it off of a Lead Belly record.
Yeah.
But they had me doing a version of it that was the original version written by a piano player whose name escapes me right now. I never met him, but I know his name very well. I just can't think of it at this time of day.
Yeah. Well,
I can't even sing before 9 p.m.
Well, sorry about that. My guest is Ramblin' Jack Elliott. He's in Sacramento this Friday evening at Harlow's. We're listening to songs from his most recent record, A Stranger Here. Let's listen to New Stranger Blues.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
I'm a stranger here, just floating your town. I'm a stranger here, just floating your town. Just because I'm a stranger, everybody wants to dog me round. Lord, I wanted to do my good gal know I'm here. Lord, I wanted to do my good gal know I'm here. Well, if she do, she sure don't seem to care.
Ramblin' Jack Elliott, I saw this morning about a 5-minute-long video that I understand was made by your daughter, Ayanna, about the making of A Stranger Here. It's a great video. It looks like it was recorded in someone's house.
Well, that is correct. Yeah, the recording studio was in the basement of a beautiful mansion over in Pasadena. As a matter of fact, just when Van Dyke was getting out of the car, and my daughter was standing in front of the house there with a movie camera filming everything. One of the neighborhood ladies who was very worried about the fact that she knew that the producer of the record lived in that house and was a musician. And she was real worried about the neighborhood going downhill.
and did it?
She shouted at us. She said, are you paparazzi? And I said, no, I'm her papa. She drove away.
Yeah, that's a great story.
Very disappointed.
Yeah, I guess so. The producer of the record is a guy, Joe Henry, who's a few decades younger than you.
Joe, I met Joe in Italy one time, and we had a great time playing. He played the night after I played in a little place in northern Italy. But the first time I met Joe, I was with my daughter, and we were going to the very, very first time that they had the Rock and Roll Awards, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which took place in New York City about 20 years ago. And my daughter flew there with me, and the plane was delayed in landing due to fog at the airport. And a young man hailed me as we were coming off the plane. It was Joe Henry. And he said, hey, Ramblin' Jack, come with me. I'm Joe Henry. I've got a car waiting. And he escorted us into the limousine. And we were about 45 minutes late for the show. And in fact, I was too late to receive. I was supposed to be receiving an award for Woody Guthrie posthumously.
Oh.
With Arlo. Arlo was there. He received the award, so I wasn't there to help. But I managed to get some chocolate cake and some stale cold coffee.
You got something out of it.
Yeah, and Bob Dylan was there, and the Beach Boys, and
Wow.
Oh, there were a tremendous number of, I saw Mick Jagger and Elton John.
Well,
so it was a worthwhile trip for me, but unfortunately I wasn't able to do the appearance that they were expecting me to do on stage.
Well, august company there, but I don't think any of them could sing a song quite like this. This is Ramblin' Jack Elliott from his album A Stranger Here, and the song is Soul of a Man.
Won't somebody tell me, answer if you can. Want somebody to tell me, what is the soul of a man? I'm going to ask the question, answer if you can. If anybody here can tell me, what is the soul of a man?
I've traveled. Jack, that is just such an amazing song and an amazing performance.
Oh, thank you for playing it. I'm thrilled to be hearing it. I hadn't listened to it in a while, and it kind of shocks me.
Really? Why?
Well, I forgot about it. You know, I recorded that about 2 years ago, and I don't spend much time listening to my records.
Yeah. Well,
I'm on the road a lot.
Well, and speaking of being on the road, Ramblin' Jack Elliott is coming to town. He's at Harlow's in Midtown Sacramento this Friday evening at 7. And we've been listening to songs from his Grammy-winning country blues record, A Stranger Here. Ramblin' Jack Elliott, thank you so much for joining us today on Insight. It was a real pleasure talking with you.
Looking forward to it. Thank you, Jeffrey. Nice to meet you.
Great. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producer, Liz Cazares. And this is no ordinary day for Liz Cazares. It's her last day working on Insight. She's been here with us 3 days a week for many months now. We wish Liz all the best. She's been a great part of the team. So thank you, Liz. And thanks also today to Ben Adler for his work in our opening segment about high-speed rail. Insight's assistant producer is James Morrison. The technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. We will be back tomorrow.
If you're coming too late, your mama will be gone. I'm raring to go, red shoes on my feet. My mind's set right for a tin Lizzie seat.